You're listening to Better Half Chats, a dialogue between a seminary graduate, Andrew, and his candid wife, Bethany. That's me. Today we're going to talk about Philippians 1, 3 through 11. I thank my God in all my remembrance of you, always offering prayer with joy in my every prayer for you all, in view of your participation in the gospel from the first day until now. For I am confident of this very thing, that he who began a good work in you will perfect it until the day of Christ Jesus. For it is only right for me to feel this way about you all, because I have you in my heart, since both in my imprisonment and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel, you all are partakers of grace with me. For God is my witness, how I long for you all with the affection of Christ Jesus. And this I pray, that your love may abound still more and more in real knowledge and all discernment, so that you may approve the things that are excellent, in order to be sincere and blameless until the day of Christ, having been filled with the fruit of righteousness which comes through Jesus Christ, to the glory and praise of God.
This passage and this, even this whole book has always been interesting to me because Paul is writing this from a Roman prison, or most likely a Roman prison. We don't know that for sure, but most likely he's in Rome and he's in prison, and he's this is not the a prison that you would think of like today's prisons. Like, this is probably, he wasn't treated very well. Probably he was in a really dark, dank place, and probably smelled bad. It was probably just not a good situation. And so it's always amazed me how he's in this situation, but yet his writing, and you can see in his writing just the joy and the peace that has really come over him. And so it's always been an encouragement to me in that way, how he is so happy despite his circumstances.
So I didn't know he was in a prison when he wrote this, but I was also kind of wondering, why are you so excited about these people? And I didn't even know he was in a prison, and it was still shocking to me, just as a normal person. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Why you're so, well, what have the Philippians done? You're just so happy about them. And then I got to verse 6, and he says that he who began a good work in you will perfect it until the day of Christ Jesus. And I thought, oh, okay. Christ is doing a good work here. It's not what the Philippians were doing. And my mind didn't even go there until I read that part. I was thinking, what makes them so awesome? I want to be like the Philippians. And then I realized Christ is working in them.
Right. And it's important to know that Paul, he starts out at pretty much every letter that he writes, except for Galatians. He starts out the letter by thanking God for the people. But it is evident in this whole letter that he has kind of a special affinity for the Philippian church, and we don't really know for sure why that is. We just know that they had been especially supportive of him in his ministry, and not just financially. Financially was part of it, but they were also just very, I guess, in tune with what Paul was doing, and they were very much on board with him. And so in a lot of ways, they were just a great source of encouragement to him. Paul founded the Philippian church on his second missionary journey, and the way it would work is they kind of, he'd kind of take the course through several different cities, and he'd start a church in each city, and then when he came back, he would come back through those cities. And so sometimes certain members of their party would get left in the city, and then when they came back through, they would pick them up again. Well, this is one of those occasions where he's on a missionary journey. He stops in the city of Philippi. He plants a church, and then when he comes back, he comes back through. And then it was towards the end of this journey that he was actually arrested, and then that produces the occasion for writing a letter to the Philippians, because he's been back. He's been through the city twice, and he's gotten to spend some time with these people, and they've obviously developed a pretty special connection with Paul. And so that's kind of the occasion for the letter.
I thought it was interesting in verse 8, too, how he says that he longs for these people. And I think that's interesting because God has created us and wired us to have a strong desire for Christian community. And and he can see the fruit in these people and knows that God's working in them, and that that kind of community is just like a strong desire for him. I thought that was really cool. Like, we're wired for that.
Yeah, for sure. He definitely, you know, puts out that idea that, yeah, we're all meant for that type of community. And he uses this word in the English Standard Version that's translated yearn, that, you know, kind of, to me at least, makes it sound like, you know, he requires this just as much as he requires, like, food or water, mm-hmm. you know? Like, he, like you said, he's built for it, and he really needs it to survive. And especially in this scenario that he finds himself in, and it shows me, you know, in the times of my life where I feel, I guess, especially down, or if I feel especially, you know, disconnected, those are really the worst times, you know, mm-hmm. and you really see that in the way Paul talks about Christian community here.
Yeah. I think it's interesting too. He's talking about, and back in verse 6 again, you know, talking about Christ perfecting the work that he started in the Philippians. And I immediately thought back to what we were talking about with James and the trials. And if you read this letter through, you know, at least the verses that are focusing on today, you just get this overwhelming feeling of, like, thankfulness and joy and just, like, happy, happy, joy. Like, this is such a sweet friendship, and this is, like, a great letter. And then I think about what it takes for Christ to perfect a work in you. And I think, you know, the Philippians are probably going through some hard times. They're probably going through some trials. They're starting a new church. It's not easy. They're probably, and I don't know this, they're probably dealing with issues within the church, but they must be leaning into Christ heavily because they're not grumbling, and they're being generous with their money, which are things we've talked about the past few weeks in other chapters of the Bible, and we've come to the conclusion that it's really hard to be generous with their money, and it's really hard not to grumble. Mm-hmm. But this is a community of people that Paul desires to be with. He longs for these people. Like, they are exhibiting the fruits of the Spirit that that we all desire, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and there are issues going on in the church that kind of come out, you know, later in the book, which is often the case in Paul's letters. He'll write the first half of the book to be more theology, and it's more, you know, theologically geared, and then the second half of his book or his letter usually is more practical advice and that sort of thing. But in Philippians, it does come out as more of, like, you know, warnings against some of the things that were starting to happen in the church, and so, you know, people who were preaching things that were not the gospel. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the last half of the book is kind of about that. But yeah, it everyone obviously has, you know, struggles. And of course, in this time of history, life was not particularly easy either. Mm-hmm. Clearly these people do have, you know, the Spirit of God in them if they're so peaceful and Paul enjoyed their company so much.
And it also goes back to what we talked about last week about being encouraging and pointing out what people are doing right. And maybe he has some things that he thinks they could do better or different, but he starts off by pointing out what they are doing right. And mm-hmm. We were talking about last week how that is really important in any kind of Christian community, that we're just uplifting of each other. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely what Paul does here in this letter.
Yeah. Going back to verse 6 again, too, I think about this verse a lot because it's always been really encouraging to me that that Jesus will, or that God will bring the good work that he began in you, he'll bring it to completion. And so if there are times that I'm feeling like I'm not making progress, or mm-hmm. or I'm not, you know, I'm not developing as a person or as a believer or whatever, this verse has always been encouraging to me because it reminds me that, you know, God is constantly at work. God is constantly working in your heart to do something, and he's going to bring it to completion. That's always been really encouraging to me. And I feel like that verse is just particularly applicable to, you know, just your everyday Christian, you know, on the street, you know. Mm-hmm. There are some verses that, you know, are not so applicable in the New Testament. For instance, when you start talking about, you know, women and head coverings and that kind of thing, obviously mm-hmm. women don't do that kind of stuff anymore. And so we kind of have to parse through the cultural trappings of that verse a little mm-hmm. bit. But this verse 6 is one of those where I feel like there it is right there. We don't really have to parse through a lot of cultural background to understand what that means, you know?
Right.
And so that's why it's always been really encouraging to me.
And it's a good promise that we can just cling to all the time.
Yeah.
And that's probably what he was giving them too, you know, this will be finished, you know. But then he goes on and he does kind of give them, like, and I'm praying for you in verse 9 that your love may abound still more and more in real knowledge and all discernment. So, I don't know. It's interesting. It's another one of those, like, God will have his will done, but you have to, like, meet him halfway. Mm-hmm. You know, where I get so confused because I'm like, do I matter to God's will? Or, you know, it's like...
Yeah, so that's in verse 9, yeah. So, yeah, it's he's praying for them that their love will abound more, which they obviously already have a lot of, you know, love and care for each other. But yeah, with the knowledge and discernment thing, it is an interesting direction he sort of takes it.
Which we talked about in John, how we were kind of discovering that knowledge is just as important as love in a lot of ways when you're a follower of Christ, and that you need to exercise that part as well as, you know, your heart and your mind. But the thing that kind of gets to me sometimes is we were just saying, like, God will finish the work, you know? And so sometimes I use that as an excuse to be lazy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and so here's another way to look at it, too, as far as the love thing. So obviously he's talking about that your love will abound more and more. But he says it must have, the love must be with knowledge and discernment. So the knowledge and discernment goes with love. So maybe a way to look at it is that love, in order for it to be genuine, must be discerning, you know, what is right and wrong? What's the correct way to love this person? Or because you can look at two different people and one action is loving for one person but unloving for another person. You know what I mean? Mm. So maybe he's talking about, you know, their love being seasoned with the knowledge and discernment that it takes to properly love someone. Does that mm-hmm. make sense?
Yeah, I didn't think about that.
Because it could be that he's talking about, I don't know, I suppose it's possible that he's talking about knowledge and discernment as a separate thing. But it seems to make sense to me that the love, or that the knowledge and discernment is like kind of an accessory
how you
to
love.
Love.
You yeah. love smart.
Right. You love smart for it to be a genuine love, for it to be real love, it has to be discerned.
I get that. I'm trying to think of examples of times when someone loves without discernment. And I'm thinking of, I'm thinking of like street corner preachers,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Sure. That's a good example. So someone like Bethany and I are University of Georgia graduates.
Go Dogs.
Go Dogs. There is a guy, I don't know if, who knows if he still comes there. Maybe he's listening today. Hello. no, but everybody called him the Tate Center preacher because, you know, the Tate Student Center at UGA. And so he would go
everyone
out.
Everyone knows what you're talking about right now, I'm sure.
Right. Okay. Just making sure.
It's just a name of a building at UGA.
It's probably the most crowded place on campus.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, there's a stage there and you can rent out the stage for various events and whatnot. And this guy, the preacher, would you know, rent out this space. And I'm sure every university has a place like this. But anyway, he would go out there and he would just be yelling at people and, you know, talking about how evil they were. And if you were going to go out and drink tonight, you know, you're just the worst person that ever lived. And, you know, it was not like, I don't remember him ever saying anything about God loves you. It was just like, you're an abomination and God's gonna destroy you kind of stuff. And so then I remember one day he had kind of been preaching and then I was walking through and he had just gotten finished when I was walking through and he walked up to, I guess, take a break or whatever. And there were a couple of students that were obviously Christians that were talking to him because they were trying to convince him that what he was doing was wrong. And it was clear to me, like, he did think that his actions were loving.
Mm-hmm.
And just through the things that he was saying, he was standing his ground and saying, you know, this is what God has called me to do. This is what love is. Like he thought he was doing like tough love, I guess. But just from looking at the interactions between him and some of the students that were there, you could just tell that this wider and wider chasm in those people's hearts was developing between them and God. It's just mm-hmm. his words were just creating a larger and larger gap. Yeah. And
It became a place for people to come and get some entertainment, and they would shout back
yeah.
responses, and then it would be like they laugh at him if he didn't have a really good response, and then it just kind of became like for people who were not believers, it was kind of a fun place to come, like, get their kicks.
Yeah, it was just like a laughing stock, yeah.
That was not the best way to love them, but... Who right. knows what seeds might have been planted in that? But for me, walking by, it did not show me love. So, like, that was not reaching me.
Right. Yeah. It's true that we have no idea what's going on in people's hearts.
Yeah, exactly. There's no way to know. But for me, I know that that wasn't the way to show me love. Maybe if he had a plate of cookies, it would have been a little better.
Tate Center Preacher, we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, email us at betterhalfchats@gmail.com. Let us hear some of your positive stories.
Yeah.
I guess that is an example. I'm trying to think of maybe a less, more of a like day-to-day example.
Yeah.
Can you think of a time when you've...
Well, I mean...
Or a time you've loved someone without discernment and you kind of were like, ooh...
Yeah, I mean, I think just, I don't know, it's hard for me to think of an example in my own life, but I guess just as a more general example, like, obviously, disciplining your kids is a good thing, right? You need to do that in certain circumstances, but there's also a wrong way to do that. So, like, while you may be doing an action that's technically loving, the way you did it could have an effect on whether it comes across that way or not, or whether it was in fact loving or not. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I don't know, if Harper was a little older and she was, you know, did something that was wrong or that could have really hurt her or whatever, and let's say I just lashed out and kind of screamed at her instead of being patient with her and, you know, explaining why she, you know, explaining how what she did was wrong, you know, that could be like a loving action that I was disciplining her, but the way that I did it could be without discernment and without the knowledge of what's going to have the most effect on her.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I think that maybe that is another example. Do you think that works, or?
Yeah. I feel like most of the times that I act without discernment, I'm just thinking of examples in my life and thinking of a time where I may have loved without discernment, but it usually comes back to that I wasn't really actively loving, trying to love that person. I was being selfish or prideful, you know, yeah. So trying to think of a time when I was like trying to love someone, but I wasn't being wise, and but I'll keep thinking, maybe it'll come to me.
Yeah. Or if you have any ideas, email us at betterhalfchats@gmail.com. I'm just gonna say that after every point.
Yeah, email us, we'd love to hear from you. But then I go down to this next verse, and so now that you kind of changed the way I think about loving with discernment, I'm wondering if I'm thinking differently about the next verse, approve the things that are excellent. So are we thinking he's talking about your actions, like so that you can kind of check your own actions and only act with excellence, or are we talking about like just the things in your life? You know, I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah. I guess I'm kind of drawn from the commentary that I read for this. It's sort of talks about the difference between, okay, well, some things are clearly right, some things are clearly wrong. Sometimes that line between right and wrong is not always so clear. And then on the, you know, right side of things, sometimes there are things to do that are better than others, right? So, you know what I mean? And that's the difference between morality and wisdom. Whereas morality is just talks about what things are right and what things are wrong, wisdom talks about what things are best and what things are better and what things are good. You see what I mean? The difference between good, better, and best.
All right. Having one of those moments where I'm like creating a new compartment in my brain for this thought. And things are developing there. Okay, so if he's saying that you may approve the things that are excellent in order to be sincere and blameless until the day of Christ, are we shooting for best? Is excellent best?
Yeah, that's what I would say.
Ooh.
Is that the best is the wisest thing, the wisdom of it. Not just thinking about what things are right and what things are wrong, but what's the best.
Yeah.
You know, what's
for like choosing the best. See, like, okay, this is where my perfectionist mind is going to go a little bonkers. So I'm having to like break it up for a second. So choosing the best and the things that matter and choosing less than best and the things that don't. Because if you tell a perfectionist to strive for excellence, they're going to like explode. You know what I mean?
So
like things that matter, like the dishes being clean to excellence does not matter.
Right.
You know? The house being excellent at all times does not matter.
Yeah, not like physical things. Keep in mind, this all goes back to the love and the spiritual environment of this community.
Right. So treating other people with excellence, using your time wisely.
Yeah.
Yeah,
of course, like, physical things can be ways to do that, but it's not. Yeah, you're right. Like just doing those things for yourself, because you want everything to be neat and tidy, or because whatever. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about the way your actions relate to other people in community.
Yeah, that's convicting, because definitely having the wisdom to set your priorities in line with God versus your own desires.
Yeah.
And God desires the community and the spreading of his word,
mm-hmm.
and for us to lean into him for everything.
Yeah.
Which is not always my priorities.
Right, and that's the idea that really, yeah, is the most difficult thing. These are things that would be pleasing to God. Like in the verse 11, he says, all of this should be to the glory and praise of God. So, like you said, aligning your desires with God's is the most difficult part of all of this. Because naturally, our hearts are not going to do that.
Too bad there's not like an easy button you can press to just like realign your heart.
Right. Did you just make a reference to the
easy button.
The staples?
Yeah.
That was easy.
Yeah. You can't do that with this.
Right. Yeah. There's no easy button, but it all goes back to this is God's work in you. And so it's not us doing the improving. It's not us aligning our desires with God's. It's God doing that. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, this is an act of God, or it is an act of God. And in a lot of ways, we have to just surrender to him to allow him to do that. And, of course, we have to, you know, we do actions in our day-to-day life, and our actions mean something, but God is the one that's actually changing our hearts, and our actions flow out of our heart.
Thanks for listening to Better Half Chats. Like we said in our chat today, we love to hear from you, and we just thank everyone who's contacted us and given us feedback about our chats. It means the world to us. But if you want to contact us, you can contact us at betterhalfchats@gmail.com or tweet us at betterhalfchats. Next week, we will be discussing Ephesians 5:22-33. So read up and come prepared to chat.